When are people going to see that nothing ain't never going to change unless somebody finally makes up its mind to stand up and fight? Damn.
Netrich Radio presents Hopping Mad with Will McLeod and Arliss Bunny. Now, here's Will and Arliss.
Welcome to Hopping Mad. I'm Will McLeod.
And I'm Arliss Bunny. In 1969, Swiss psychiatrist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross published a book called On Death and Dying. In this book, she introduced the concept of the five stages of grief, and she did her research at the University of Chicago, and this research is just another thing that people at the University of Chicago got wrong. Contrary to what you may be hearing from a number of sources right now, the five stages of grief are a myth. Her original results were not supported by research, and peer-reviewed research, which followed up, did not verify her results. However, in 2009, Professor George Bonanno from Columbia University released a book called The Other Side of Sadness, What the New Science of Bereavement Tells Us About Life After Loss. This came 40 years after Kubler-Ross and was based on two decades of peer-reviewed research, which included thousands upon thousands of people. He concluded that, as has been summarized by Scientific American, the ability to rebound remains the norm throughout adult life. Bonanno's research has also found that in addition to resilience being natural, it is not something that can be taught through specialized programs or therapy. His research shows that real laughter and smiling is truly healthy, and he found that practices common in grief and trauma counseling, including asking people to talk about their loss or cry about their loss, can actually be harmful. Bonanno's research has shown that there is no right way to grieve, and there is no typical response. And as we go through this grief as a party and as caring people in this country, I think it's important for us to remember that lots of people will be going through this in very different ways, and there is no right way. What matters especially in this short term is that we take care of ourselves and that we don't get marooned inside this loss. How we get through this grief and fear, how we move forward together, will be the measure of us as a nation. Also, and this will be important, really important to remember, and Will is going to talk about this more in a little bit, how we make room for and ultimately bring along with us those who will soon be disillusioned when they come to grief under the Trump administration. They must also be written into this chapter of history. The first chapter will be about how we fell. The second will be about how we endured. The third will be about how we rise again, because we are stronger together. So as we look at how we get from here to there, how we get through the next 4 years, I guess one of the things I've been thinking about are, what are the possibilities? And I'm going to start with the craziest one first, but it's not impossible. So I think it's worth probably just mentioning. There is the possibility of a President Pence. Mike Pence is someone with whom I deeply disagree, but he won't blithely take us into a nuclear war. So how do we get to a President Pence? Well, Donald Trump, not the picture of health. He could actually die of natural causes, but more likely is that he would be impeached. There's a possible fraud conviction from Trump University. It's possible if he's held responsible next month in the civil case relating to the rape of a 12-year-old girl with which he is theoretically involved. Grounds for impeachment could be found relating to Trump's mental health. And whatever Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell could realistically dream up could be grounds for impeachment because, frankly, they do really hate Trump. But most likely of all, Trump could be impeached due to his rapidly surfacing ties to Russia. All of this is not...
about Russia, we have a president whose loyalty to the United States is questionable at best.
And who the Russians just
admitted.
They've admitted to having interfered with this election in his favor.
And the FBI has evidence of it and decided to talk about the emails rather than threatening anyone else. And by the way, here's what we need to do. We need to organize. We need to make sure to stay strong in Virginia and New Jersey and take those state governments, which I think we can do. And then we need to take the House back. Yeah. And when we take the House and Senate back, we need to remember the Hatch Act, which I want to remind you has no statute of limitations.
There you go.
So the things done by Comey to illegally interfere in this election, those need to be prosecuted. We need to investigate the FBI to determine who broke the law on this, who leaked, and we need to punish those people for doing it because they violated the trust we place in them as federal agents. That's something we need to do now.
Yeah.
We need to... Ugh.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's okay. No, you're completely right. Totally right. I'm with you right there. I also think, however, that mistakes were made by lots and lots of people, including me. One of the mistakes I made in this election, one of the mistakes I've made for much of my life, is that I've believed that the majority of this nation has better angels. What I learned in this election is that white people may appear to be decent, but they are entirely willing to accept extreme bigotry and hate in exchange for what they consider to be their other priorities.
And you know what? We're not just talking about conservatives here. We are talking about left-wingers whose own personal sense of political purity allowed them to sit back and allow a fascist to come to power.
Literally the next point on my page.
Or,
in the case of so-called progressive purists, these people are not progressive by any stretch. They are purist fanatics. They are no different than religious fanatics the world over, and they are just as dangerous. Like the bigots and white supremacists, they are the least among us. My husband, before this election, at the very beginning of the election cycle, said two things that turned out to be prophetic. He said, Democrats don't know how to message well. This is Bernie's great gift, but it's also Trump's. Hillary connects almost magically, in fact, with intimate groups of people and with individuals, but big messaging, that absolutely was not her strength. And in the end, that turned out to be one of the major failures of this campaign, without a doubt. We have to solve that. We have to figure that out. I don't care if we hire all of Madison Avenue. We have to solve that freaking problem. Somebody who sells us fizzy soft drinks ought to be able to figure out how to sell us a presidential candidate, for God's sake. Sales is something this country ought to be able to figure out how to do. I cannot believe the Democrats can't wrap their minds around that. The other thing my husband said at the beginning of this cycle was, Democrats don't get mad. He said, we are the party of the nice and the party of the politically correct. And that's not where people are right now. And you know what? I'm done being nice. I am finished with politically correct. Bigots, white supremacists, sexists, left-wing fanatics, anyone who flies the traitorous Confederate flag, all of them are deplorable. And not saying so in all capital letters is the thing of the past for me. The deplorables interpret polite as weak. The deplorables interpret quiet as acceptance. Guess what, assholes? We're coming for you. You thought you were pissed off? You just pissed off people who were actually smart. And we're coming for you. You deplorables thought you could ram your anti-intellectual, anti-science, anti-factual, anti-education ignorance down my throat? Guess what? Science doesn't need you to believe in it. Climate change doesn't need your permission. Facts are facts, and the future will be inherited by those with the intellectual skills to claim it. And we will do that with strength and in ways you never imagined. Today is yours, you deplorables. But after your white hooded parades are finished, after you have blown up the very institutions of government upon which you rely, we will be there, bigger and stronger and more organized than ever in our history. We will stand. And if that's too feminist for you, on the night of November 8th, there was this from Marcos Melitzos, the founder and publisher of Daily Kos. He said, the next 4 years are going to effing suck. All the progress we made the last 8 years will be lost, and we will be starting from zero. I ask one thing for now. Please stop talking about leaving the country. Conservatives suffered through 8 years of Obama and never gave up. So why would you prove yourself weaker than those assholes? We are stronger than they are because we have the moral high ground. We don't need to debase ourselves and support an asshole sexual predator. We don't have to resort to hate and voter suppression to win. Our core voters aren't dying off. They are growing. Arizona, Georgia, Texas are the future. The Rust Belt is waning. But Trump tapped into something visceral, and whites responded. America is changing because of those people, and I don't like it. So it didn't matter that we crushed our own numbers. They made people feel like their backs were up against the wall, and it worked. They voted as if their lives depended on it, even though they didn't. There's no way to sugarcoat this. We're in for a world of S-H-I-T. It's going to be awful, but we'll be here bedeviling Trump and his party, making their lives as miserable as possible until we either succeed or I'm in effing prison. No one is leaving this country. We love it. We love our people. So we're going to fight for it. But for now, let's take a moment to grieve because America isn't what we thought it was. And then we start fighting. How do we start fighting? First of all, I think we do that with Keith Ellison at the DNC. I think we make him chairman of the DNC. My cohort was sitting on the couch letting the country down during this last election. People of color carried the water in this election, and that should be reflected directly and strongly in the leadership of the party. I not only want to see Ellison in charge, I want to see leaders chosen by the Latino, Asian, and Native American communities in positions of real power at national and state levels across the country. Also, we must move millennials up now, fast, now. Elizabeth Warren, Howard Dean, Joe Biden all have critical roles to play, as does from his position outside the party, Bernie Sanders, who would, by the way, not have won. You would have had to be deaf not to have heard the roar from the angry bigots of our nation. This country would not have elected a Jewish socialist, or as they would have called him, a communist, who has never been anything other than a politician. They wouldn't have done it. So there is a future, and in 2010, former W associate and counselor Ed Gillespie became the chairman of the already extant Republican State Leadership Committee. It had existed since 2002 with no real effect until Gillespie, but Gillespie had a plan. And under him, that committee, and by him I mean GOP dark money, launched the incredibly successful Redistricting Majority Project, also known as Red Map. They shrewdly recognized, as has been said by the Wall Street Journal, that he who controls redistricting controls Congress. They took in and used with laser-like precision $30 million. They flipped 19 state legislative bodies in the 2010 election. They gained control of 10 of the 15 states, which following the 2010 census would either lose or gain congressional seats, and therefore they had the power to redraw slash gerrymander the new congressional maps. After he leaves the White House, President Obama and former Attorney General Eric Holder are putting their energy into a new lift, the Democratic National Redistricting Committee. They're bringing together national and state-level Democratic groups, unions, and progressive organizations. Their intention is to exert influence slash control the new redrawing of congressional district lines in 2020, putting an end to the current dramatically unbalanced gerrymandering. They plan to use data to target flipping the seats in state legislatures which have the best return on investment. In individual state house races, they will pour money and organizational support to those Democratic candidates who are in a position to flip seats, with a special emphasis on the many state legislatures where flipping a small number of seats will lead to flipping the entire state house or Senate. Coming right out of the gate, they are targeting the 2017 off-year elections in Virginia and New Jersey, which Will was just now talking about. And for me here in Indiana, I'm going to find out which 2018 races the NDRC is targeting and how to get involved in those. The last thing I'll have to say is that there is an incredible meditation, the F That meditation, which I have really been enjoying this week on YouTube. I'll put a link up for you on our website, imhoppingmad.com. It will not only relax you, it will make you laugh. You will enjoy it. And laughter is good for us right now. A little anger, a little grief, a little laughter, and we'll get through this, all of us, together. Will?
There are a number of things that we need to do, and we need to do them immediately. I am upset about the fact that we, as a party, are spending this time eating ourselves rather than learning the lessons of this election. We killed ourselves primarily by having an internecine conflict that became very bloody and very painful. We need to be discussing what policies we ought to have as Democrats when it's not an election year. We need to do the work on that part before we're going into the primary elections. And then in the primary elections, we need to see them as part of the general and be working to reach voters with personal stories. We need to do messaging now. That's what the Republicans were doing, but it's not what we were.
With great success.
We also need to stop being so spineless when it comes to our beliefs. We oppose everything now. What the Republicans did to us when we had the White House, to Barack Obama, was make it so that every single nomination requires 60 votes. We filibuster everyone he nominates. We fight tooth and nail for everything. We work with him on nothing. When Republicans want to pass something, we let the Freedom Caucus and the other guys fight amongst themselves.
And frankly, when they want to pass something, even if we freaking wrote that law or wrote that proposal in this Congress, even if it's one of our ideas, if they want to pass something, we oppose it. We Obamacare it.
Yeah, which means we either oppose it or we don't vote. We don't necessarily vote against it. We can vote no preference. We can drag everything out in committees. We can put amendments onto these bills that are poison pills that will keep the Freedom Caucus from voting for it. We can force the Republicans to vote down Donald Trump's suggestions.
We give them nothing.
And then if someone says something, we say, well, Republicans control the entire federal government and can't get anything done. We knew how to get things done. They've always been the problem. They've always opposed everything we've tried to do. So if you want an effective government, we need to vote for a Democratic majority. Democrats are very good at running Congress. So give it back to us. And we'll prove that once we do control the House and Senate, we will prove to the American people that we're trustworthy with our actions rather than our words. It's important to have discussions in the long term about what policies we ought to have, but we really need to focus on strategically reaching out to rural areas. If you pull up a county by county map of how people voted in this election, you will look at these rural areas and you will see people voting 80 and 90% in some constituencies for Donald Trump. That's much higher than the normal percentage of Republican support. Some places, it's in the high 60s usually. Now it's in the 80s.
And places that went for Obama went for Trump in the 80s.
Yeah, that happened in some areas. And it happened because people in rural spaces feel ignored.
And get this, here's the statistic that most shocked me about this whole election. Combined, we lost because of Rust Belt states, because of narrow, narrow margins in Rust Belt states. You know how many votes that was combined, all told, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan? 60,000. 60,000 people total made the difference in this election.
Yes. Also, one of the things that we didn't lose was our support from 2012. Voter turnout and votes are still being counted. But there's an article up at Slate that I'm going to link to that shows that voter turnout did not actually fall particularly much. What happened was that rural areas, the Democrat vote collapsed there. Our vote in rural spaces vanished. And that happened because we didn't try to reach those folks. And we haven't been trying to work with them for 40 years. Not in ways that are effective. These communities are hurting. They are hurting just as badly as any other impoverished communities. And rather than hearing the messily phrased cries for help, we have spent the past 20 years calling these people inbred hicks whenever they try to raise an issue that's important to them. And then we are surprised that they don't vote for us. We've got to start building the rural Democratic Party, and we're going to lose seats out there. We're not going to be able to take much from the Republicans, but we'll get the Democratic vote up high enough that the actual Democratic areas in the cities can put it over the top. And once that's done, we talk with our local Democratic parties, we hear what the people out there need, and we have Democrats come out to these spaces, provide party support, and also provide legislation that will help these areas. And say that was Democrats who listened to the Democratic Party in this area. If you want more, actually vote for Democrats and we'll be able to do more. We slowly build up over time support for Democratic and ideas and policies, not by having bloody screaming fights with each other, but by being one big tent party that is able to reach parts of the country that need help. And just to talk about a couple of those things that easily could help us win votes. We've all heard of Virginia hams, right? The famous Virginia hams where they have pork that eats acorns and stuff like that. There's no region control on that. There's no support for that industry. If you are a small farmer who's trying to grow Virginia hams, you have to have your ham cured in an FDA facility. You're not allowed to cure it yourself. That was done to protect the large-scale pork industry. We have not done for our farmers, and the small farmers we have generally are luxury goods farmers, people who make things like Virginia ham. We have not done for them what Europeans have done for their farmers. Virginia ham should be competing around the world with stuff like Iberian pork or prosciutto. We should be focusing on those small communities that produce things like that and grow that part of our economy. We need to build more schools. There are people who go to schools in rural areas that are far, far worse than you'd see in some of the worst parts of the inner cities. Poverty out there is very, very bad, and no one ever talks about it. And no one ever offers the options that can grow their economy. We need to increase wages out there so that local people can start building their own small businesses again. We need to do infrastructure, and we need to actually reach out to these people and tell them that we care about them and that we're fighting for them.
So here are two things.
If we do that, we'll win their votes.
Yeah. Here are two things that are a big deal, actually, in rural areas, as I sit in a tiny, tiny rural area right at this very moment. Fast internet is it, what it costs. You would be stunned at what it costs me, hundreds of dollars a month to have fast internet where I'm sitting right now. So my neighbors don't. It's basically the net to that. It's a problem. I have a really good friend who can't get on internet from her home because she's way out in the country and between hills, and they can't. Anyway, it's a whole thing. It is an extraordinary problem in rural areas. So just like the Tennessee Valley Authority and the electrification of the Appalachians, internet needs to go to every home in this nation, in particularly rural internet. The other thing that's a huge deal, and Will talked about building new schools, but as much as it would make some sense in some areas to build new schools, what lots and lots and lots of rural schools need is basically funding for a bunch of smaller buses and the bus drivers to drive them. And I'll explain why. If you're a kid in a rural area, you get on a bus at 5 a.m. You sit on that bus for 2 hours because your district can't afford to have very many buses. So every one of those giant buses makes this laborious, very, very long circuit of your county. If you had a flock of little buses that could go out and deploy, kids are on buses for 45 minutes. 45 minutes is still a long time, but it's not 2 hours. 2 hours each way. So things like that matter to families. And I don't think that in big cities, I don't think those kinds of things even cross people's minds.
Another thing that we need to talk about is how we do gun control messaging. In rural areas that I've lived, a chest freezer is an investment, and people literally put meat on their families' tables with rifles. There are people who, when they hear gun control, they think that they are going to lose part of their capacity to feed their family. That is part of what we need to be sensitive about. And I have not heard anyone talking about gun control in a way that is sensitive to the needs of rural communities. We could easily phrase this as we're trying to get guns out of the hands of terrorists. We're trying to keep terrorists from buying guns. We could do that. If you're on the terrorist watch list, you can't buy a gun. We could talk about making sure that we just enforce the gun laws we have, which are so weak as to be completely unenforceable. That would do rather a lot to bring down the spate of mass violence that we have in this country. 85% of gun owners, when asked, say they support these sorts of things. But the Democratic Party has totally failed to do any kind of messaging. And I think part of the problem is that there are a ton of liberal gun owners who have just not been able to organize themselves properly. Left-wing gun owners need to organize and need to be able to work with the rest of the party on gun control matters to make sure that we have sensible gun control ideas in place. We haven't done any of that. And the other thing that we need to do is we need to talk about the way of life of every American. There's a way of life in the cities, there's a way of life in the suburbs, and there's a way of life out in the countryside, and all of them are important, and all of them deserve support.
And all of them message differently.
Yes. We need to reach out to every American and support the way of life they have chosen. And we also need to make it possible for people to move between these spaces. If you are someone who lives in a rural area, it's very, very hard for you to move to a city because you're likely to have a job that pays good money for your area. If you live in a small town and you're making $26,000 a year, you're likely to have a comfortable home. You will be able to rent an apartment for $500 a month. You will have options available to you to save for a house. But if you want...
I'm sorry, Will, $500 a month? I'm sitting in a 3,000 square foot house. my mortgage payment is less than $350 a month.
Yeah. No, I lived in a swanky two-bedroom apartment that was multiple times the size of my current apartment here in DC that was walking distance from the town center and had an internal washer dryer and all the bells and whistles. That was $500 a month.
Yeah.
For a massive apartment in a great location with all the amenities you could possibly want. You can afford that if you're working at some of these jobs out there. But the problem is that those jobs are all surrounding one big industry. We need to diversify the economic portfolio of our rural areas. We need to build for them something beyond the coal mines, something beyond the one or two big industries they'll have. There are ways to do that. There are ways to do small business investment. There are ways to encourage growth out there. But we have been so focused as a party on growth in the cities that we have not been focusing on making rural spaces someplace that people would want to live, want to move to, want to raise their children. We need every part of this country to be built up. And we have not messaged to these different spaces. And we have not talked about making people's lives easier in these areas. And so when Democrats actually take control of states, we need to start doing some of that. We need to talk about rural development. We had a rural electrification program. We need to do rural internetification.
Exactly.
We need to find a better word for that, but we need to create the rural internet project and make it so that small businesses out there can have the exact same access to technologies and resources that city and suburb businesses have. And we haven't done any of that. And another thing that we need to do is we need to start hitting the Green Party very, very, very hard.
Because
the Green Party in Michigan took 1.1% of the vote, 51,000 votes. Those are votes that would have put Hillary Clinton over the top if they'd gone for Hillary Clinton. And we have not at all hit the Green Party because we thought, that'll give more attention to them. And I don't think we need to have our candidates hit the Green Party. I mean, smaller scale folks need to hit the Green Party. So it's not people punching down. And so I'm going to take a swing at them right now because here's what the Green Party actually is. They're scammers. The Green Party is a scam. Jill Stein and Jammu Bacara did not run local candidates for Green Party seats in local parts of this election. They only ever run for president. She didn't release her tax returns because what Jill Stein does is professionally runs for president. This is how the Green Party makes their money. They get donations from disaffected Democrats. They run a crappy campaign where they don't spend very much. They let people feel good about their activism, and then they laugh all the way to the bank with the money that they have stolen from well-meaning people by pretending to be a political party. But they're not one. They are a scam. They are just like Newt Gingrich, professionally running for president so he can have his book deals.
Exactly.
They do the same, but with donations to the party so that they can sit around feeling great about themselves and employing themselves. That's what the Green Party does. It's a scam. And until that is exposed, they will continue to cynically steal money from well-meaning progressives while completely and totally failing to do any kind of left-wing stuff. That is why, by the way, Jill Stein threw the Russian Green Party under the bus. That is why you heard no one in the Scottish Green Party, which is an effective political party, going out for Jill Stein or supporting them.
I was just going to ask you, what do you think about the European Green Parties in comparison to the American Greens?
European Green Parties actually contest small seats. The European Green Party has people in Parliament. They have people in the Scottish Parliament. What they failed to do is the Scots could have taken out a Conservative. They could have made it so that there were no Conservatives in Scotland. And the Greens were asked not to run a candidate, and they did anyway, which was a tactical blunder on their part. Some Greens agree with me on that. Some Greens disagree with me. But an SNP person could have been sitting in the seat of David Fundell right now if the Greens had been more tactically intelligent. The Greens in Scotland and in the rest of the UK actually participate, and they're not a scam like the American Green Party is.
Yeah, they are legitimately competing for power on a complete basis.
Yeah, and they don't get involved in this conspiracy theory nonsense generally that the Green Party in the United States does. The Green Party cynically picks whatever pocket issue of some disaffected progressive is Doesn't matter if it's sane or not. They'll go after the anti-vaxxer stuff. You saw Jill Stein trying to get anti-vaxxer votes. They'll go after the people who are crazy about Wi-Fi and talk about how they need to take screens away from children and that Wi-Fi signals are affecting their brains. That wasn't a blunder on Jill Stein's part. She's literally trying to get the votes of crazy people because she wants inflated support and she wants their money. She doesn't care about actually carrying forward ideas or policies. That's what the Green Party does in other countries on this planet. They actually get people elected on the local level, and then they participate in the process. The U.S. Green Party doesn't do that because it's a scam. Coming up, we have our interview with Denise Oliver Velez, and we will be discussing the election and where we go from here. Stay tuned.
With State University of New York at New Paltz. She is an applied anthropologist and teaches cultural anthropology, and she also teaches in the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Department. But that's only the beginning of her song. Denise is a feminist and activist of long standing with deep experience going back to the Young Lords Party and the Black Panthers. Denise is also a featured writer at Daily Kos and was our very first guest on our very first Hopping Mad. Denise, you seem to me to be the best possible guest to have with us on our first post-apocalypse show. Welcome.
I think I'm alive. Thank you.
On our very first show, I asked you this. I asked you, you began participating in the civil rights movement when you were 16, and through all the losses, literally assassinations, you have managed to tenaciously cling to hope despite fierce winds. In light of what's just happened, how do we cling to hope?
Well, from my perspective, the best cure for distress and lack of hope and depression is to get out and put one foot in front of the other and organize. There are so many things that we can be doing. I mean, we can assess what we maybe didn't do enough of or whatever, but there is no way in hell that you allow yourself to be knocked down and knocked backwards and knocked out of the game. Struggle is long term. And that's one of the things that I find that a lot of people don't really get a grip on. You don't get involved in struggle if you want to always have positive results and see the end of the road. There is no end of the road. It's grinding forward, you know, dealing with the ups and downs, and you just keep on keeping on, as folks say down south.
What's the best way to deal with the downs then?
To find something to bring you out of the downs. Find some rays of hope or something positive. When I went to school this week, I mean, I had students who were weeping. I had students, we actually had somebody on suicide watch. Transgender students are particularly vulnerable at this time, and also students who are from immigrant backgrounds. And
yeah, one of my transgender friends threatened to kill himself on election night. Calls to the suicide hotline have jumped 500% in the LGBT community.
Yeah, it's difficult, and it's particularly difficult with young people when they sort of they get all sort of high on hope, and then when that's smashes to the ground, they don't have a sense of where to go. I think a lot of older people who have been through setbacks and been through this before know how to just, you know, pick yourself up and dust yourself off. And it's not like Pollyannaism. It's just that's what you've got to do.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine said people have microwave radical struggle. They want, you know, pop it in the microwave and we're going to fix all of this, you know, in exactly 30 seconds. And it just doesn't work that way. And it's one of the reasons why I was able to go there, be there for students. And what was really good was we sat them down, talked to them, gave some hugs, and then students had organized a protest. And students, faculty walked out, and I think we had about 800 or 900 students who gathered together, protested, and then we headed off for town and marched through town and came back. And by the time we got back, there was something in the kind of solidarity of seeing students of all colors and backgrounds and ethnicities and whatever coming together. And we had had a really bad racist incident take place, racist, sexist, anti-immigrant incident take place the night before on campus. And plus there were Trump supporters riding through town in their pickup trucks, shouting racial slurs and homophobic slurs at students. And anybody who lives in a college town kind of knows that the campus is really a huge portion of what the town is. So there are students out on the streets, you know, all day and all hours of the night. And it was really difficult for the students to cope with that. Most of them are 18 or 19 years old, and they've never been through anything like this. For a majority of them, it was their first time voting in a presidential election or first time voting, period. And they were all high on, even the students, I have to go back and say a lot of the students at New Paltz were Bernie Sanders supporters.
Yeah.
And but they shifted toward the end and understood the necessity of, you know, voting for Hillary, whether or not that was their first choice. And they had all gotten very up on the idea that she was going to win. And so it was like a double loss for some of the students who had shifted over for Bernie and then voted for Hillary. And they were devastated. And when the impact of what this means finally sunk in. I mean, I'm horrible because I bludgeon them, you know, over and over again. You've got to understand the importance of the Supreme Court. You've got to understand how legislation affects you, you know.
Yeah.
And so what's beginning to happen is that this is a wake-up call because they're now seeing how this thing called politics, which is separate from them, has a direct impact on their lives. This is no longer stuff in a textbook or in a sociology, you know, or political science classroom or women's studies classroom. This is now, it got real.
We're giving the nuclear codes to narcissists,
mm-hmm.
you know, a man who is not psychologically balanced.
I had a student who was absolutely devastated. She's an anthropology student, and she works in looking at issues on the environment related to agriculture. And she actually worked with a professor and helped draft some of the paperwork that was taken to the climate change conference. And she was bordering on hysterical because she's like, can I use the F word?
Not for another 20 minutes. When we get to the second part of the show, you're welcome to say whatever you like.
Oh, okay. Well, but she was like, we're messed up. Okay.
Yes.
Starting with an F. And she was just crushed because she was one of the students who was really, really clear about how important global accords on climate are, and the idea that there could be a president who doesn't even believe in climate change and a president who's going to, you know, put somebody in as the Minister of Agriculture or whatever you call it, Secretary of Agriculture, who's going to, and the environment, and they're going to do fossil fuels. And she just couldn't believe it. And she ran out of the classroom, and you know, I talked to her later, because she was at the point of, this is hopeless, you know, we're all going to die. And I was trying to find ways to get through to pull her out of it. But it was not an easy day on campus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think it was an easy day anywhere.
Right.
My parents are like original members of Sierra Club, and they went down to, to headquarters essentially. And people were just, I mean, these are, you know, adults who have fought these battles and, you know, been through the wars, literally been through the wars, and absolutely just destroyed. People were sobbing.
I was trying to cope with school. I was trying to cope with home and family members, people calling me, my goddaughter's kids. She's Puerto Rican. Her husband is Persian American. They're both, you know, American citizens. Her kids are sort of a mixed background, but her kids were freaked out. They were like, are we going to be deported? And she was trying to explain to them, no, you know, but our friends are going to be deported. And my husband works at a social service agency, and a lot of the clients who are elderly, most depend on Medicaid. They were devastated. A lot of his coworkers are gay men who were flipping out.
Did you hear what Trump, Paul Ryan said yesterday about Medicare?
Yes.
Oh, yes. My God.
And the irony of it is, so many of the people who voted for Trump, I forget, I saw some statistics posted on Daily Show.
My cohort. It's people 45 and older that elected Trump. And retirees in particular, and they're going to get destroyed by his cuts.
Yep. Yeah. And you know, it's the same old, same old. I mean, I have my own perspectives on what the dominant variable is, and there are multiple variables in this. And for me, this sort of fear of the other. And when I use the term racism, I'm not just talking about black-white kinds of issues. I throw all of the other isms into it, too.
Us, too.
That it's so much more powerful than even paying attention to the fact that you're, as my grandmother used to say, cutting off your nose to spite your face. You know, and that's exactly what they've done, except they've cut off their lives to spite those people.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing that most shocked me, and I'd speak about this earlier in the program, I kind of have a rant earlier in this program, but I speak about this when I say that the thing that most shocked me about this election, and I didn't know about this country. I did not know that there were no better angels for so many people.
I guess that's where you and I differ. I mean, I live with the fact that there aren't particularly a whole lot of better angels in this country. I'm able to step back and assess that we've moved a little forward down the road, and we have. The thought of seeing that forward progress undone is disheartening, but I have never been in denial about where a lot of people in this country are coming from. It may be better than 1865, but having lived not just in New York. I don't live in, you know, I didn't spend my whole life living in the bubble, and having traveled and visited every state in the United States, I'm very aware of still how regressive too many citizens are in this country. That doesn't stop me. I don't get up every morning and go, oh, lordy, lordy, it's so terrible. There's so many people filled with hate. You know, I can still laugh. I can still read my science fiction. I listen to music. I go to work. I plant my garden. But I've never been able to live not knowing how bad things are. And that goes beyond just questions of race and ethnicity, because my first most devastating incident in my life that woke me up was when I was in the first grade and we moved to a very WASP town, State College, Pennsylvania. And my best friend from New York was, you know, named Carolyn, and her last name was a Jewish name. And the little girls in the brownie troop pulled me off to the side and said, "You're friends with Carolyn?" And I was like, "Yes." And they said, "Have you seen her horns and tail?"
What?
And I was like, "And God. Yeah, okay." And I was like, "What? Have you she's a Jew. They have horns and tails." And, you know, there I was in my little kid self, and my eyes got big, and I ran off and ran home. "Mommy, Mommy, we have to leave. We have to go back to Brooklyn, you know. These people are really, really..." And, you know, my mother did what moms do and sat me down and gave me the, "You know, there are ignorant people in the world" lecture. But that was... people talk about getting woke. That actually was the first woke in my life. And from then on, as we traveled about the United States, as my dad changed jobs, I got one more woke after another. You know, the Klan riding, I actually saw them. Jim Crow, living in the Jim Crow South, you know, moving around the country. So I was hardened to it. And my grandmother, who's white from Bible Belt, Kansas, is the person who started talking to me about racism, and she got it 24/7, you know, because people would say things to her, "Here's another white lady," and she taught me. She said, "Don't be blind, you know, there, find out who people are and really find out who they are," she said, "because there are a lot of bigots in this world, child." And so I came through the school of my eyes are wide open.
I grew up in Northern California in basically Sonoma County, so one of the most liberal places in the country, and my parents were always extremely, extremely liberal. So I knew that it was out there. I worked to elect Harvey Milk. I, you know, went door to door. I started with that kind of activism when I was really young, but I just didn't know. I had never seen the Klan ride. I had not experienced that for myself. And this election, it broke my heart.
I understand it. I mean, not everybody has had the same kind of experiences. This is a wake-up call for a lot of people. What is bothering me, and, you know, I'm in hot water again. I'm always in hot water for saying things very bluntly. What is bothering me is that some people are still not seeing it.
Oh,
and
sure.
They're making 900 excuses for, you know, why people voted for Trump, you know, and I'm kind of like, oh man, you know, if you can't see now that anybody that decides to vote for somebody who's going to cut off all of the things like Social Security, you know, and Medicare, not Medicaid. People yeah. have in their heads that that's for those other people, except they don't really know. So that's what's been bothering me, because I think that this is a time that people who are to the left, and that's a broad left, because everybody's got their idea of what liberal, left, progressive, all of those terms are. Yeah. If people are still not able to see it, and when I tried to talk about the racism, and that's racism, the stretched racism,
yeah,
I have people saying to me, you people and your identity politics, we don't want to hear about LGBT, we don't want to hear about xenophobia, we don't want to hear about sexism, we don't want to hear about whatever, because it's about economic insecurity only.
No, it's not. I mean, I'm an economics wonk. No, it's not. If it was economic insecurity, the entire conversation would have been different this election. The only thing that touched on economic insecurity in this election was the trade issue.
You know, that's true. That's very true. One of the things about this, though, is there are some people who have convinced themselves, and I've talked to them. These are the Trump supporters that I know personally. They have convinced themselves. These are people who actually don't hate Black Lives Matter. They just don't care about it, and they have trouble understanding why that is ignorance, white privilege, which is a kind of racism. But they think in their minds that they are not racists, and they think in their minds that their entire vote was about economic insecurity. That's what they have convinced themselves of. Mm-hmm. And there are also people, and there is an argument to be made, you know, there are communities in this country, in rural areas, not the South, but the totality of our rural spaces, that are in a state of economic emergency. And those places mm-hmm. voted pretty overwhelmingly for Trump. And I think we lost in 2010, we lost our bulwark against something like Trump. We lost Democrats able to communicate with their communities, and they had been doing a pretty poor job of that overall, but that were at least capable of doing that work. And we lost also the advocates for those spaces that would have been sounding the alarm. And that, so what we have is the rump of the Democratic Party in these rural spaces that has not been able to effectively advocate for these folks because the central party hasn't allowed them. Rural spaces and urban spaces are not communicating to each other their needs.
The thing is, my only answer to a lot of this is, if it's about economic insecurity, then the most economically insecure people would have been voting for Trump.
Exactly.
And who's at the bottom of the economic totem pole in this country? We know what that data is.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm not just talking about Black people, because I look at the numbers economically, for example, the high level of unemployment in Puerto Rico. And, you know, Puerto Ricans who fled the island to Florida to survive. And
who
the
went
Puerto
for,
Rican vote.
For Hillary in huge numbers.
Yeah. Yes. And in fact, I happen to pay fairly close attention to the data coming out of the Latino community. And I was kind of appalled at the reporting I saw, you know, New York Times and all that kind of stuff. Oh, the Latinos went for Trump and whatever. And I was like, I don't think so. So I trotted over to Latino Decisions, which is the only polling agency I trust, because they're the only ones who really know how to interpret that kind of data, and they do it bilingually.
I was going to say, and they poll in Spanish,
Yep, and they flipped out, and they were tweeting all over the place, lies, 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 the Latino vote, you know, went for Hillary. And but there's a meme that the traditional media was trying to push. And so I agree with you that there are rural areas in this country where people are economically insecure. But what I don't agree with, from what I hear from a lot of people, they say the word rural, and rural means white, Yes. Except that that's not reality either.
Right.
Because there are a lot of rural black folks and there are a lot of rural Latinos.
Yeah.
And rural Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
In particular.
And so I want people to define the way they categorize things. So when you say the working class, that doesn't mean white working class.
Right. When I say rural, I mean all of that. I'm talking about the reservations when I say rural space. And those were blue. There were pockets of blue, and that's interesting. And we need to pay attention to that. But I'm saying rural spaces in general are where Trump won a lot of votes. And there are votes available to Democrats, and we need to go get them.
Right. But we don't.
No, I mean, we tell our stories really badly. That's something else I ranted about earlier in the show. That's my husband's, like, he was saying this from before the election cycle even started, that somehow Democrats never manage to figure out how to message what they're actually saying. They never figure out how to tell their story.
Yeah.
They need to hire some cultural anthropologists, ethnographers, and this is not just with national elections. We haven't figured out a way to go after people who don't vote at all, and that's a huge number of people in this country. We have not figured out a way to address young people in terms of how to make politics matter. And I think we depend too much upon, go to the website, you know, League of Women Voters or whatever. These are all nonpartisan sites. The kids in my classes say to me, Denise, how do I figure out who to vote for?
Yeah.
They have no clue.
We have to cut it off there. We will be back with Extra Mad with Denise in just a few moments. But Will and I would like to send out our thanks to the team at Netroots Radio and especially to you for joining us today on Hopping Mad. Denise, thank you for being here today. You're just fabulous and so interesting, and we can't wait to hear more from you in just a few minutes. But folks out there, you can find the broadcast version of our show on Netroots Radio Mondays at 8 a.m. The podcast version, which usually includes our Extra Mad extended interview, is always available on Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, MyTuner, TuneIn, and Overcast. Our website is imhoppingmad.com. You can listen to or download the show from there. We welcome your comments, thoughts, tweets, and suggestions through the website or via Twitter at I'm Hopping Mad. Will is on Twitter at WillMcLeod99, and I'm there, of course, at Arliss Bunny. Next up is K-Grow in the Morning here on Netroots Radio.
Welcome back to Hopping Mad. We're here with Denise Oliver Velez. Denise, you were talking about your students asking who to vote for. How do we organize better as a Democratic Party in messaging to them, do you think?
I think that we need to figure out ways to do what high schools are not doing. They don't teach civics.
Yeah.
And they at all.
Right.
And every semester.
You took civics, right?
Yeah.
I took civics.
I was able to have a civics class at my high school, but it was because it was a pre-law and public affairs magnet program. And civics was only for those pre-law and public affairs magnet students. Nobody else was required to take civics or wanted to take civics. And what that means is that there was a government class that was split half the year with an economics class, which was taught by someone who was really only able to give people the basic day-to-day how to balance your checkbook economics stuff in the 3 or so months he had to do it. So that's where we were. They got a very, very small, like, 3-month crash course in there are 3 branches of government, but not the deep discussions I had about how things work. So we're not teaching civics to any of our students today.
And that break is what, at Gen Y? Is that where the break is?
Yeah, I think Gen X is where that break started, and it's just gotten worse. There's a tiny, tiny number of us in the millennials and the people who come after who got a little bit of that, but not as in depth as it should be, and usually only in specialized programs.
Denise, is that what you think? Is that where you think it falls?
Yes, and it's frightening. And every semester, I don't teach political science. I don't teach sociology, you know, but since I teach anthropology, I just have shifted the way that I do things. And I ask my students every semester, I go, how many of you can name who your representative is in Albany? That's, you know, the state house here in New York. And they look at me with this blank look. They have no clue. I go, so who are the two senators that represent New York State in Washington, D.C.?
Oh, that makes me sad.
Blank. I had one kid once who said, Somebody Schumer. Right. Okay. And now in my women's studies class, I do the same thing. And you would think that they would know the name Kirsten Gillibrand.
Right.
Yeah.
Nope.
Yeah. You went have one of the hottest and best senators there is going. And it's a woman. You'd think they'd know.
Who speaks Chinese. You'd think they'd know.
Nope.
How amazing.
This year, my student said, can we be released from class because Bernie Sanders is coming to New Paltz? And I said, fine. Okay. I said, do you know why he's coming? And they said, no, he's coming because he's campaigning for Zephyr Teachout. Who?
Oh, God.
So they went. They went to the rally, and they came back. And I said, they were all excited. Hey, we get to see Bernie Sanders. And I said, so what did Zephyr Teachout have to say? I don't know. And I said, okay, let's pull up her website and look at, you know, what the issues are that she's talking about and this and that and the other. It never occurred to them to go look at somebody's campaign website. You know, she lost, by the way.
Yeah, I know. I was crushed by that. Actually was, you know, as I was reeling from everything else that was going on and trying to look for bright spots, I went to hers thinking, oh, well, at least we got Zephyr Teachout, right? And then just, you know.
She, I guess I can say this. I think she ran a horrible campaign. And I went to a house party to, you know, do stuff for her. And there, when I got to talk to her face to face, I said, you know, there are like 5,000 students on my campus. And I told her what had happened after the rally. And I said, you've got to figure out a way, your campaign's got to figure out a way to get people onto or in those areas where you've got all these young people and figure out a way to connect with them and get out the vote. Them. They're going to show up. It's a presidential election, but you need to have them understand who you are, not Bernie Sanders is coming and you're some kind of, you know, tail end of the dog.
Yeah, opening act. Yeah, exactly.
And she kind of looked at me and said, well, I think we tried. And then she shifted her gears in her conversation to, it was a group of women of color, of various backgrounds. And her entire conversation was about the hedge funds and the banksters.
What?
You heard me.
Okay. I saw her at Netroots Nation. I saw her speak at Netroots Nation, and she was fabulous. But I got to admit, she did talk a lot about banksters. I just didn't think that's what she would be talking about in her campaign.
Well, but this was in a gathering of progressive women pulled together But it was like no talk about when you're, from my point of view, when you're campaigning, you need to talk about bread and butter issues.
Yes.
And you tailor what you're talking about. If you're a good, a politician is a job, okay? And you can either be a good politician or a not so good politician. And you have to assess your audience, who you're talking to, how you connect with them viscerally so that they are going to understand that you're going to fight for the things that are important to them in their lives. And very frankly, the group of women that were gathered at this particular event, I've never been to any other events of hers, so I don't know, but she certainly didn't connect with the things that these women were. And I know on her website that she has positions that would have, but nobody's looking at her website. They're talking to her face to face. And you were talking about messaging and how Democrats don't do particularly good messaging. Well, if you can't message face to face.
Yeah. You know, that's, I have to say, I was with Hillary from the very beginning. I was, I'll admit it here, but the, you know, I got to say the thing that Bernie really did figure out how to do was how to message. I mean, he really nailed the hell out of that. So did Trump. And
Trump has a great message. Hate, fear,
exactly.
You know, xenophobia, you name it. And it connected.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Which is why my heart is broken. But
so what are we going to do now?
Yeah. So what are we going to do now? One of the things that I talked about earlier in the show and that I know I'm going to pay an awful lot of attention to is this new redistricting project that President Obama and Eric Holder are working on. Because I think, mm-hmm. you know, targeting and flipping seats in targeted legislatures is, you know, in other words, red map for the Democrats, is how we, you know, get back control, not only in states where we can then move on issues that affect us locally. But so it's not just that we can, you know, redraw the lines and fix the gerrymander and, you know, have some shot at taking back the House. It is also that if we can flip these legislatures, we get some control in our own states back.
Yes. I'm 100% behind that. And the other thing that I did with my kids, you know, who now know this is how this is going to affect me. I said, I want you to take a pledge. You're going to take a pledge to vote in 2018.
Yes.
You're going to put into your cell phones reminders. You know, they all have cell phones, and they can put on their calendar something to alert them. You're going to find out the date of your primary, and you're going to have an alert. Your phone's going to go off, you know. And they solemnly, they all said, I solemnly swear to vote in 2018.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that, frankly, my husband talked about and that I ranted about earlier in the show is that, you know what? We have to get mad. Black Lives Matter is not wrong. We have to get mad. You know, Democrats try to come from this place of political correctness and being nice and, you know, love Trump's hate. You know what? Anger is also pretty damn motivating.
Yeah. And the thing is, we need to get mad as the Democratic Party. If we don't, we're not going to be able to motivate people because right now people in this country are hurting very badly economically. I would say even spiritually, this country is in trouble. And unless we can bring out the fury of the old progressives of FDR's era and take our fury out on these people and let these people see us fighting hard for them, we're not gonna matter as a political party. We have done this weak thing for long enough. It's time to actually throw a punch. And we haven't been willing to do it.
Well, you know, my background has been be mad and be mad and at the same time serve kids breakfast.
Yes, so, yes. There is a line.
And so I was sitting here going, fantasizing, can we please bring back the Black Panther Party, the Young Lords, and the Deacons for Defense of Justice to watch people's backs? I mean, I know that that's, you can't ever sort of turn back the clock on that, but I agree with you. Be mad. And be mad, but also be organized. And
yeah.
We're not doing a good job of, when I was in the Lords, twice a week, we had what we called community PE classes, community political education. And we had young people, and we also had old people who came, and we broke stuff down. You know, this is why we have a right to land, bread, housing, justice, peace, you name the issue. And this is what we're going to do about it. You know, the hospital's not serving us. We're going to shut that hospital down and force the city to build another one. We got people mobilized. We worked in tandem with what I consider to be really progressive unions like SEIU.
Yeah, they're great.
And who were hospital workers, and a lot of Lords and Panthers actually after the, you know, demise and the death of those organizations killed by COINTELPRO went into working with those unions, and they're still out there doing it. And we need to figure out, if the schools aren't going to teach civics, if the schools have fallen down on, they don't teach history, they don't teach anything, we need to figure out ways to, when I go to my local Democratic Party meeting here where I live, which I stopped going. I got so disgusted, I stopped going. First place, I'm the only person of color that has ever been there. And I kept saying, you know, there are like 10,000 Latinos in this area. Blah, blah. Why is nobody
here? In a
here?
University there, town, yeah.
And when I go and look, and I'm 69 years old, and I'm one of the young people.
Okay.
Wow.
It's like, excuse me, but what is going on here?
Well, we need to turn over the keys. You know, your generation and my generation right behind you, we need to turn over the keys to Will's generation right now, fast.
Will, how old are you? Can I ask?
I'm 31.
Okay.
Yeah. And I agree with that. We need to find millennials, recruit them as candidates, and put them up. I was talking to Jesse LaGreca about this last night, and he, one of the things he's saying is it feels to him like in his area, Democrats only have one question for potential candidates they're trying to recruit, and that's, can you fundraise? They're not looking for people who are personally able to message or who personally represent things. When you have the Tea Party holding these protests, they run out and find millennials at them who are conservative and pull them into the party and make them do things and run them for local office.
Mm-hmm.
And they
aren't doing that.
Yeah, the party does the work of the fundraising.
I agree 100%. Delico sent me down to Texas to a meeting down there, and because I was supposed to work with talking about how to do outreach into the Latino community. Mm-hmm. And on my way down, I sat on my little smartphone. It's my new toy. My students made me get one. And I went on Facebook, and I went around, and I found all these Facebook pages of young, active, you know, Latinos in their community. And I collected a group of names, and I threw this out to the group. I said, how come nobody's recruiting? Run some young people for local positions on the school board, on the, you know, the city councils. Start feeding the pipeline. And it's not enough to say, oh, yeah, there's the Castro brothers.
Right.
Yeah.
Hello.
I love them, but it's not enough, yeah.
And that can be done all over.
With every single group.
That's right. With every single group and getting young people into the process. There are too many. Republicans run unopposed for so many positions in this country. It blew my mind when I looked at some of the data. And I think that, you know, I support this idea. You know, it's nice that they're putting up Keith Ellison to run for the head of the, what is it, the DNC. But I think it should be full time.
Yeah. I support Keith Ellison too. And in particular, I was, again, I was saying earlier in this podcast, in particular, because people of color, you know, carried the water in this election. And, you know, whereas my cohort dropped it, you know, we stayed at home on our living room couch watching, I don't know, the Apprentice apparently, but so having Keith Ellison run the DNC, I think that's important, but who else he brings in around him, that's essential. That's critical.
Yep.
From community activist organizations get included, that millennials get included. I think Howard Dean ought to be back at the DNC in a big way. And, you know, obviously Bernie ought to have a role and Elizabeth Warren ought to have a role.
I think we need to really have that 50-state strategy that Dean had, but I really think that Keith Ellison is the right person for now because he's one of the folks who can really heal the party, I would think. He's got the backing of moderate Democrats like Schumer, who trust him because he deserves people's trust. And he's got the backing of the progressive folks because he was one of these early endorsers of Bernie. He's a
right.
Bernie guy.
Yeah.
And I look at Keith Ellison, and I've met him personally on several occasions, and I trust this man.
Me too.
And I think we need that. And also, he's a member of the House. Democrats, he can do his DNC job and then swing in to vote against a Republican thing every now and again.
Well, yeah, it's not like Democrats are going to have a lot to do in the House over the next, you know, 2 years.
That's true.
Yeah. So
he needs to get some excellent full-time people who can execute that. I was appalled at some of the comments that I read that people who were objecting to him.
Oh?
Seriously?
Oh. What? Yes.
What's the objection? Yeah, I can't even imagine.
Well, if we're going to get those people, you know, those white people who voted for Trump to come join us, I don't think that he's a particularly good face to put on it because he's black and Muslim. Yes.
I don't think the people who we're trying to reach out to know who the chair of the DNC is.
Listen, I read those comments and I flipped.
Yeah.
I'm not particularly diplomatic when people say stuff like this. And that was a response from people who are, quote, unquote, progressive.
Well, it's an incredibly racist statement, number one. And number two, catering to racists is not what we should be doing right now. I am talking a hell of a lot about reaching out to white people, but you cannot do that by axing the members of your coalition who have been fighting hard for you. If we cannot win, if we decide that reaching out to rural white people means that we have to abandon the progress we have tried so hard to make for people
for
of color,
of us together,
for women,
yeah.
for LGBT stuff. We need a party that puts all of us first, not a party that says, okay, I guess we have to work with racists now. That's not where we need to go.
Can you please put that on a plaque so that I can quote you? Because I said exactly the same thing, but when I say it, it's, you hate white people. You're a racist. And I'm like, what?
Well, yeah.
Yeah,
so,
when you hear my rant earlier in the show, you'll you can put that on a plaque. Because that's pretty much what I'm saying, yeah.
I was so upset. I shut my computer off and went for a walk in the woods because I was fuming. You know, no, I'm sorry. We don't embrace Trumpism to get Trump voters. No.
Right.
That's not who we are.
Yeah.
What we do is we reach out to people in those spaces who Trump is going to hurt very, very badly, explain to them why they are being hurt, offer them a solution, and then drive a massive wedge between them and the KKK, whom they actually do hate. These people genuinely believe that Trump is not a racist and that all the racist stuff is coming from people they don't want to be associated with. And they think that those open racist folks make them all look bad and they want them to go away. There's a way for us to use racism as a wedge between people who are just ignorant and participate in racism through ignorance and people who participate in racism gleefully. There's a wedge issue we can use there. And we have to message about it properly. But if we do that by saying we're not going to challenge perceptions and we're not ever going to do any work against racism because we're afraid of offending these people, then we're going to lose anyway, because then we hurt our base. The way that we reach out to these people is not by calling them.
Yeah. But you just said the key word. We hurt our base.
Yes.
There are a lot of people who don't understand who our base is. I'm always chiming in when they say, and the base, and I go, hello, do you happen to know that black people are a part of the base of the Democratic Party? Have you looked at our voting over the years?
They are a pillar of the Democratic Party. Without them, the whole process falls apart.
Especially black women.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
I've got to put in the cheer for us.
Yes.
Well, what was that? It was a statement I read on Daily Kos the other day that black women did the work that white women refused to do once again.
Yeah.
Sadly, part of what part of what pushed me to, I mean, I have been had all kinds of pejorative things hurled at me when I came out and supported Hillary, and you know, given my politics over the years, which have been actually to the left of Bernie Sanders.
Yep.
People were like totally bemused, you know, by that. And I said, well, my mother is a member of Delta Sigma Theta sorority, and people don't understand what that is in the black community. But because our sororities are not like something out of, and fraternities are not like Animal House. They are political institutions, and if you run down the list of all of the black female elected officials in this country, you'll see that a majority of them are Deltas.
Yeah.
And Martin Luther King was an Alpha. I mean, I can go down the list of just about every major figure in our community, and I had looked at Hillary speaking to the Deltas back in 2013, there were like, oh, I don't know, 20,000 of them were in D.C. for a convention celebrating their centennial. And she's speaking in front of 14,000 Deltas who were urging her to run. And because these are women, I'm so tired of people talking about low-information black voters. These are women who are politically astute. They've been doing this. They do the work. They vote. They get out. They vote. They train their... My mother, a Delta, you know, took me to vote from the time I could walk. I stood in the booth, and she'd lift me up, and I'd pull that thing to put the curtain back. And she told me, she said, people in our family died to get this vote. You better don't tell me you're not going to vote.
Yeah.
And that is, multiply that by households across the United States, black women vote. And if people don't understand, no, we're not the whole base. You know, we're only 13% of the population of the United States, but we play a major role in the Democratic Party, and I'm tired of being overlooked.
Yeah.
And Latina women are about to join you in big, big numbers.
Yes. I have been waiting for the day. I spend a lot of time on Latino voting and looking at it and pushing it. I'm working with most of my Latina students are now Dominican, and they're beginning to get involved in politics here in New York. And I'm so happy to see that. And I was elated to see the work that was done by organizations like Voto Latino, you know, across the country to begin to get people up, out, registered, and to the polls. And, I mean, Trump, we can credit, actually, Trump for motivating people with his horrid attacks. But it's important that we figure out, as the Democratic Party, how to sustain that and how to encourage it. And like you said, put people up and run them for office. Young people, millennial Latinos.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I'm talking about, I want to talk about this again. When I talk about rural spaces, you have political Democratic Party branches that I tried to join as a young person, and they never got back to me. I would be like, when are your party meetings? What's your organization? I tried for a couple of years to find out when the Democratic Party local Democrats were meeting. They never got back to me. We need to kick our local Democratic parties in the rear, because mm-hmm. you have a group of usually just old white women who aren't organizing their parties. And that's not to be mean to old white women, but there are some of them that need some help and with party organization. And they need mm-hmm. to be willing in these regions to reach out to the Latinos and the Black folks who do live in these areas and who do vote and who do need to be organized.
And they haven't got a clue how to do it.
Yeah.
When I went to my first Democratic Party meeting, everybody turned around and looked at me like, why are you here? You know, who are you? You know, and I was like, I mean, luckily, you know, I have long-term experience with organizing and being in spaces where I might be the only face of color, so yeah. It doesn't throw me. But I said to myself, oh, my God, you know, if somebody who didn't have my background had walked in the door, they would have turned around and run out the room.
Right.
You know, so I introduced myself, hi, you know, I live in the neighborhood, I wanted to get connected. It wasn't like, hi, you're new, welcome, come in, meet everybody. No. And like I said, they didn't have a clue. I sat down and I had demographics data with me. In my county, there are X number of Latinos, and there are also X number of people from the Caribbean who settled up here. And there are blah, 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 and I don't see any of them here at this meeting. And what have you done in the past for outreach? What have you done, you know? And this was like something no one had ever raised.
Yeah.
I know that problem because I've lived out in these areas. And the thing is, there's a double problem here, because those folks don't know how, and also no one from Central Democratic Party comes out to these spaces to do training or organizational work.
Right.
We have a dual problem of these folks can't reach out to their own communities, and there are a ton of resources we could provide them. The Republican Party does that.
Yep.
The Republican Party does candidate recruitment. The Republican Party has trainings for their staff and for their volunteers and for their local Republican Party groups. Why don't we?
We do in some places, but we don't in rural areas, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure how well we do in some urban areas either. Like I said, it's not that kind of education. And one of the things that, and I'm going to be harping on this a lot, is that we need not to depend on the League of Women Voters and groups that are,
yes,
have to be nonpartisan. We need to have handy little handbooks. You know, this is about the messaging.
Yes.
That give people voter information. I mean, I know that movements like Moral Mondays have been doing a good job with, you know, going out and getting out the vote. But even they're constrained. The NAACP can't take a stance. You know, they can't be expressly building the Democratic Party. And we need to have some serious thought and work put into, like you said, doing the training, visiting all these local Democratic parties, running people, getting them, throwing them into the hopper. The Tea Party took over school boards all across America.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So they could legislate against science and against facts.
That's right.
And against critical thinking education, because they really don't want Americans to be able to do that.
Right. And we spend so much money on our top of the ticket, and we've allowed, I'm appalled when I look at the state legislature maps.
Do you know how little, you know, it takes an incredibly small amount of money to flip a state legislative seat? I mean, that's counted in tens of thousands of dollars instead of the hundreds of millions that we have to raise on a national level.
Mm-hmm. Flip those legislatures.
Yep.
Flip those city councils. Flip all of it. I mean, we don't pay attention to, you know, who gets put on as the commissioner of education in a state. We don't pay attention to
actually, that was
judge
a huge
elections.
Election in Indiana. That was actually the biggest election on the ballot after the presidential election. Was our the Democrats or the Republicans were determined to defeat Glenda Ritz at education here, but we were the only state in the nation with that issue.
Listen, I have colleagues who were out in Arizona, and the guy that was in charge of education for Arizona is the person that put through the ban of Chicano studies. Okay.
That's just, in Arizona, that's just.
Yep. Well, because Chicano studies is racist.
What?
Yep. Yep.
Okay, there's just, there aren't enough ways to say stupid to frame that properly. Will, did you have anything else that you were dying to make sure we get in here?
I think we've covered a lot of the important stuff. Denise, do you have any other thoughts for us?
No, we just got to do the work and raise these issues and stop focusing on just the top of the ticket. We have time. We have time now to do the building work. So let's just get it built. And I thank you so much for what you discussed today, because that makes me feel good that maybe a whole bunch of us can start saying the same things and we can get it done.
And I think
thank you for having me.
Thank you for being on. And I think that I, as a white guy, need to shout really, really loudly now about the fact that we can't decide that we're going to coddle racism. I think I personally need to be loud about that, and I'm going to.
I think that you should, because the problem is again, when it's somebody black who's saying it or somebody Latino who's saying it or whatever, then we get hit with, that's all you people whine about.
Yeah.
And so I particularly am ecstatic when a white male, use that white male privilege, please.
Yes.
Yes, ma'am.
For our benefit.
Yes, ma'am.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Take care. Thank you, everybody, for joining us here today on Hopping Mad. We'll be back next week. We have a really fabulous interview lined up. We'll talk to you then.